and built the infrastructure to impale her with it. RT partnered with Radio Sputnik to amplify its stories in another broadcast medium, on the web, and in social media. And backing up the overt stories was an army of secret Russian social media trolls who, years earlier, had established fake accounts with stolen pictures and fictional biographic data, each with a history of posting and accumulating friends. As RT went live with its traditional anti-American propaganda and newly created anti-Clinton campaign, the covert Russian trolls began reposting RT videos and stories and similar articles from mainstream media on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and other social media platforms. On Twitter, they'd learned to automate their work using bots to retweet unflattering stories millions of times, flooding the system to make anti-Clinton stories trend. After the work the Russian troll army had done during the Russian annexation of Crimea, the military intrusions into eastern Ukraine, and the Ukrainian elections of 2014. This was a battle-hardened battalion that understood its mission space and was already running at its peak. Meanwhile, Russia's spy agencies also got involved, particularly in the cyber realm. They ran both spear phishing and brute force hacking operations, gaining access to IT systems of think tanks, lobbying groups, both national parties, primary campaigns in both parties, and some state election networks and voter registration databases. By July 2015, they had penetrated the Democratic National Committee's systems, and they maintained that access for nearly a year, playing off political vulnerabilities they discovered and feeding secrets to RT, Sputnik, and the trolls. Then, just as Clinton's campaign was getting some traction, her candidacy took a serious blow from my office, of all places. The State Department Inspector General had identified a sampling of 40 emails sent or received through Clinton's private server to further investigate. Recognizing it was not the ultimate authority to determine classification, the State Department IG's office had given the emails to IC Inspector General Chuck McCullough to review. I'm sure this was very close to the last thing in which Chuck wanted to get involved, but he had a professional obligation and he led the review. On July 23rd, he reported that 4 of the 40 emails were classified, and he referred the case to the FBI for investigation. Of course, little did we know that would be the start of an ordeal that would continue through Election Day and beyond. At the time, it was just Chuck following the facts and reporting a hard truth. Secretary Clinton responded to media questions about classified emails passing through her home server, the same way she'd responded to questions about why she'd used a personal email for government business, why she had her own server at her house in the first place, and why her attorneys had deleted 30,000 emails deemed to be personal without someone from outside her circle reviewing them. She simply asserted there was no scandal and tried to move on. In this case, she insisted that she hadn't sent or received any classified emails through her server, which may be what she thought at the time. Unfortunately, this only served to reinforce the narrative the Russians had established, and to her visible frustration, RT and Sputnik, along with the mainstream outlets, continued to lambaste her. I remembered the note she'd sent to me 4 years earlier after the Diane Sawyer flap over London, the one reading, "As a longtime observer and sometimes victim of the press gotcha game, don't let the First Amendment get you down. All the best, Hillary." I'm sure she could have used a similar note just about then, but my official position prevented me from reciprocating with that kind of support to any political candidate. In August, she finally told a press conference that she'd ultimately been responsible for determining which emails to delete, and so she had made the decision. With cameras still rolling, she walked off, yelling over her shoulder to the assembled media, "Nobody talks to me about it other than you guys." Russian trolls pushed the clip, writing that everyday people wanted to talk to Clinton about the emails, but she was sequestered in her ivory tower. In September, she posted on Facebook, "Yes, I should have used two email addresses, one for personal matters and one for my work at the State Department. Not doing so was a mistake. I'm sorry about it, and I take full responsibility." When just a few weeks later on NBC's Meet the Press, host Chuck Todd asked her about a newly released email, she referred to the whole thing as another conspiracy theory. To be sure, not every slight and slander against Clinton posted on the Internet came from Russia. But Russia egged on anyone in its sphere of influence who would bash her, particularly the field of 17 Republican candidates. To use a sports analogy, Putin's attitude through the fall of 2015 was much like that of a University of Michigan football fan on a weekend the Wolverines don't have a game, cheering for whoever was playing Ohio State. Up until December 2015, Putin and Russia simply pulled for whoever was bashing Hillary Clinton. RT and Sputnik ran articles covering the GOP debates and highlighted any GOP candidate who took a swipe at her, no matter who that was. At the same time, the troll army continued to promote all sorts of conspiracy theories, including some about Clinton's health, which had been circulating since 2012 when, sick with the flu, she'd fainted, fallen, and suffered a concussion, which led to a blood clot near her brain and hospitalization. The trolls claimed that she had a brain tumor, repeated strokes, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, dysphagia, epilepsy, a traumatic brain injury, lupus, and/or HIV. I imagine that someone in St. Petersburg, where most of them were working, received a performance bonus for coming up with the story that Clinton was being slowly and repeatedly poisoned by Russian agents. I don't want to leave the impression that RT and Sputnik were focused only on bashing Clinton. They would have lost their television viewership and social media followers if they didn't produce some other content. And while Putin had a personal vendetta against Clinton, Russia's primary goal was still to breed distrust of the U.S. government. RT's coverage of Clinton's 8-hour testimony before the House Benghazi Committee on October 28, 2015, is illustrative of how they accomplished both. In one typical RT clip, posted on YouTube under the headline "Hillary Clinton Grilled in Marathon Benghazi Hearing," the anchor leads into the story, stating the hearing was part of a probe by a select bipartisan committee into what was known by Clinton ahead of a terrorist attack on September 11, 2012, at the U.S. Embassy in Libya, an attack that led to the murders of U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans. Having alluded to the conspiracy theory that Clinton knew about the attack beforehand, the clip cuts to a reporter in the Capitol quoting Committee Chairman Trey Gowdy, who said the hearing with Clinton was necessary because previous investigations were not thorough enough. So before getting to any actual video of the hearing itself, RT voiced the most damaging allegation against Clinton and quoted a congressional leader alleging that the 7 previous congressional investigations, as well as an FBI investigation, were all conducted improperly, thus providing a fairly compelling reason for Americans to question the competence of their government. The reporter continues, "Throughout the day, Republicans in the committee grilled Secretary Clinton on why more wasn't done to provide the necessary security for Ambassador Stevens in Libya prior to the attack that resulted in his death." Now, the irony of this is, when looking at congressional votes, it was actually the Republican-controlled House that voted to cut funding to foreign embassies leading up to the September 11, 2012 attack. Again, it raises an allegation against Clinton and another at congressional dysfunction. Next, the piece reports that the hearing had a heavy focus on the Clinton emails, the ones that have been recovered from the secretary's private server, particularly those that show discrepancies. The clip cuts to Tea Party Republican Representative Jim Jordan questioning Clinton, "You're looking at an email you sent to your family. Here's what you said. At 11 o'clock that night, approximately 1 hour after you told the American people it was a video, you said to your family, Two officers were killed today in Benghazi by an al-Qaeda-like group. You tell the American people one thing, you tell your family an entirely different story. RT didn't run either Jordan's question or Clinton's answer, just the preceding allegation. The clip simply shows a U.S. representative alleging that Clinton had lied and continued to lie. The reporter observes that was just one example of the nitpicking of emails, and that the burden was on Republicans to show this wasn't just a witch hunt against the Democratic frontrunner for president. Again, RT has it both ways, attacking Clinton personally and the institution of Congress generally. Finally, the clip shows Secretary Clinton as a witness. For 8 hours, she had answered questions in a cool, calm, collected, some mainstream outlets even described it as presidential manner, never breaking composure, which should have shut down any questions about her health and stamina, but of course didn't. Showing any of that footage might have undercut Congress, but helped Clinton. Instead, RT aired a 30-second video clip of Clinton smiling awkwardly while Gowdy and Democratic Representative Elijah Cummings, the ranking member, incomprehensibly yell at and over each other about the House rules for releasing transcripts of other hearings. The exchange all too vividly demonstrates why nothing gets done in Washington, and Clinton's expression of discomfort leads the viewer to imagine her as president, still unable to get Democrats and Republicans to work together. The clip aired on RT and audio segments on Sputnik. Trolls could link to RT's YouTube channel, targeting either liberals or conservatives with, "This is why nothing gets done in Washington," or, "This is the truth about Hillary, she's been lying to us this whole time," depending on which demographic their social network and followers were composed of and how Russia wanted to manipulate them. The U.S. intelligence community knew at least as early as 2015 that the Russians had a collaboration of forces working around the clock, literally in shifts, to post and manipulate stories against the U.S. government and Hillary Clinton. We told policymakers, but we didn't have any mechanism to counter RT and Sputnik. We'd been successful in building platforms for being transparent with the American public about U.S. intelligence work, but we didn't have a viable, credible path to reveal to the electorate how Russian intelligence and propaganda were attempting to manipulate them. I was less concerned that they'd picked a particular candidate to attack than that they were so aggressively engaging with the American public and doing so with impunity. By December, the Russian strategy of merely favoring whoever was bashing Clinton changed, as Moscow developed a clear favorite. Donald Trump had a long history of flirting with politics before the 2016 election, briefly running a campaign as the Reform Party candidate in 2000 and publicly discussing running in 1988, 2004, and 2012, but he was probably better known as a real estate developer and reality TV host when he entered the race in June 2015. His success as a businessman was somewhat mixed. He developed a series of structures around the world that bore his name, most notably Trump Tower in New York, and also hotels, casinos, and golf clubs. But his experience was in managing massive sums of money, not large numbers of people, and his businesses had filed for bankruptcy 6 times. Since the turn of the century, he'd largely shifted his focus to licensing his name for others' projects. And in 2011, he got into a spat with Forbes when they valued his brand at $200 million, and he asserted that his name really was worth $3 billion. Whatever the case, the Trump brand stood for wealth and success. Since 2004, he'd starred in The Apprentice, a reality TV series wherein contestants competed for a 1-year contract to run a Trump business for an annual salary of $250,000. The show ran for 11 seasons until Trump declared for the presidency when he brought his reality TV skills into the political arena. How to make an entrance, how to make headlines, and how to play to his core audience. When his campaign officially kicked off, He didn't just come out of nowhere, as many people seem to believe. Prior to the 2012 race, he had engaged pollsters about his chances and how to position himself, including Kellyanne Conway, who would help lead his 2016 campaign down the final stretch. In fact, he already was positioning himself with the base of voters that would carry him in 2016 when, in March and April 2011, he'd publicly promoted the birther theory that alleged that President Obama had been born in Kenya and therefore wasn't eligible to be president of the United States. The conspiracy snowballed with an allegation that Obama was secretly Muslim, a rumor that somehow coexisted in the same space with the claim that Obama's Christian pastor in Chicago was putting anti-American and anti-white ideas into the president's head. All of these anti-Obama conspiracy theories contain transparently racist sentiments, and the right-wing websites complained incessantly about how great the United States used to be before progressive ideas about valuing diversity in race, gender, sexual orientation, and religious expression took hold, narratives that resonated with people whose jobs had evaporated in the recession. They'd lost everything. They were angry. And the belief that the situation wasn't their fault, which it largely wasn't, was appealing. They blamed the educated liberal elite and believed that if Washington had exploited them before, it would do so again. In 2011, Donald Trump understood this anger as well as anyone in American politics, and he knew that no one incited this anger more than Barack Obama, not because he was black, or not just because he was black, but because he was seen by some opponents as a smug, overly educated liberal, one who had graduated from Harvard Law School and taught constitutional law at the University of Chicago. Obama was cerebral, seemed to never make a gut call on any decision, and then lectured the public about the decisions he had made and why he'd made them, which they perceived as condescending. When in April 2011, President Obama was heard on tape talking about people who cling to guns and religion, rural America heard that as mocking them behind their backs. This is precisely whom Mr. Trump was appealing to when he tested the election waters in 2011, pushing the birther conspiracy and demanding that President Obama produce his long-form birth certificate. He was proclaiming that he'd heard the complaints about Obama and was going to reveal that this arrogant, smug, liberal black man was not the legitimate president. It was a bluff, of course, but one unlikely to be called because Hawaii had been saying for 3 years that it would not publish the proof he was demanding. Then, in the final week of April 2011, terrible timing for Trump, who became Obama's primary target at the White House correspondence dinner, Hawaii finally released Obama's birth certificate. The president announced the death of Osama bin Laden the next day, and national surveys the following week indicated that believers in the birther conspiracy had dropped from 1 in 4 Americans to just 1 in 8. Many people have argued that being so publicly embarrassed by President Obama somehow prompted Mr. Trump to run for president in 2016. I think it more likely that he had already decided he wanted to run, and the humiliation at the correspondents' dinner helped convince him of what the pollsters were telling him in 2011, that he wasn't yet positioned to run for the 2012 election. So, over the next 4 years, he used his money and fame to legitimize himself as a Republican, first and foremost convincing the 2012 Republican nominee, Mitt Romney, to publicly accept his endorsement, and then working in fundraising circles to get invited to speak at conservative conferences and to connect with people in the power center of the Republican Party. Still, no one took him seriously as a presidential contender for 2016, because having never been on a ballot, much less won an election, he simply didn't seem to have the political bona fides. However, Mr. Trump's persona on The Apprentice appealed to the disadvantaged rural demographic of Americans in ways no one seemed to understand. He was portrayed as a businessman who worked hard, appreciated others who worked hard, and created opportunities for people who applied themselves and listened to his direction and advice. He was harsh with those who didn't meet his expectations, but he also presented an avenue for someone to earn respect and success. The winner of the show didn't get a prize or a handout, but a job, a well-paying, hard-earned job, and the opportunity to become just as successful as the show's host. That essentially was his pitch to what would become his core base of voters, when on June 16, 2015, he descended an escalator into the lobby of Trump Tower with his glamorous wife, Melania, and announced that he was running for president. He didn't use big words or soaring rhetoric. He didn't use GOP-approved talking points, and he didn't discuss the political issues of the day. Instead, he said, "Our country is in serious trouble. We don't have victories anymore. We used to have victories, but we don't have them. When was the last time anybody saw us beating, let's say, China in a trade deal? They kill us. I beat China all the time. All the time. When did we beat Japan at anything? They send their cars over by the millions, and what do? When was the last time you saw a Chevrolet in Tokyo? It doesn't exist, folks. They beat us all the time. When do we beat Mexico at the border? They're laughing at us, at our stupidity. And now they are beating us economically. They are not our friend, believe me. But they're killing us economically. The United States has become a dumping ground for everybody else's problems." To Washington insiders and political elites, this speech was a disaster. But to the people who would become Mr. Trump's core supporters, it demonstrated that finally a politician had arrived who was unafraid to voice their concerns. They heard him say, "I see you and I hear you. I know what you're going through, and it's not your fault. You just don't have opportunities to put in a hard day's work and get paid for it. You don't have a chance to improve your place in the world, and in fact, you've had the things your parents and grandparents built taken away from you before you could pass those things along to your kids. It's not your fault, and if you elect me, I'll put the country back to the way it was." This sentiment was perfectly captured by his campaign slogan, "Make America Great Again." The next lines of his speech put the liberal elites into a tizzy. He said, "I believe, very purposefully, when Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people." Then he made his first specific campaign promise. "I would build a great wall, and nobody builds walls better than me, believe me. And I'll build them very inexpensively. I will build a great, great wall on our southern border, and I'll have Mexico pay for that wall." While this was racist and xenophobic, that's not what made it appealing to his base. What they liked was that he was flouting convention and had upset, outraged, the progressive politicians and the liberal media. In 2017, David Brooks wrote in the New York Times, "Trump is not good at much, but he is wickedly good at sticking his thumb in the eye of the educated elites." Through the summer and fall, he made ever more outrageous and disrespectful statements and issued personal playground-level insults, and to the disbelief of other Republican candidates, steadily rode the wave to the top of the polls. He continued to traffic in conspiracy theories, telling a rally in November, "I watched when the World Trade Center came tumbling down, and I watched in Jersey City, New Jersey, where thousands and thousands of people were cheering as that building was coming down. Thousands of people were cheering!" This was demonstrably false and had been debunked years before, but it played to suspicions his base harbored. At a rally on December 7th, 5 days after the San Bernardino shooting, Mr. Trump read aloud a statement his campaign had issued that morning. "Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on." The statement continued, "Our country cannot be the victims of horrendous attacks by people that believe only in jihad, and have no sense of reason or respect for human life. A few days later, Trump said that as president, he would target and kill the family members of anyone who belonged to the Islamic State. His base ate it up, and the Russians took notice. In the January 2017 IC assessment, we noted that social media accounts that appear to be tied to Russia's professional trolls, because they previously were devoted to supporting Russian actions in Ukraine, started to advocate for President-elect Trump as early as December 2015. Of course, this was something we could only pinpoint in retrospect. By then, not only did Mr. Trump have a solid lead in the polls, but he'd just begun to promulgate one of Russia's favorite conspiracy theories. Promoting the fiction that American Muslims had cheered on 9/11 and that they were secretly supporting jihad in the United States perfectly aligned with Russian interests. First and foremost, it served to divide Americans, not just Muslims and Christians, but also conservatives and liberals. It stirred up long-running conspiracy theories about Clinton, particularly the rumors that she was sympathetic to extremist organizations, and that her chief of staff, Huma Abedin, was tied to the Muslim Brotherhood. And inciting anti-Muslim sentiment in December 2015 was very timely for Russia's foreign policy. The Russians had just started their Syria operations in September, and by December they were bombing Islamic State fighters and Syrian civilians alike. Horrific images of Muslim civilians fleeing the Syrian city of Aleppo had less of an impact in the United States if the leading Republican candidate was dehumanizing even American Muslims. 3 days after candidate Trump released his December 7th anti-Islam statement, former DIA director and retired Lieutenant General Mike Flynn appeared in Moscow at a gala for RT. He was seated beside Putin at dinner and was paid $45,000 to speak. I knew Mike well, and it boggled my mind that he would so knowingly compromise himself. He had more time deployed to war zones than most of his peers, which is saying something, and he understood the psychology of the terrorist threat perhaps better than anyone else. As General Stan McChrystal's top intelligence officer in Afghanistan in 2010, Mike had published Fixing Intel, a Blueprint for Making Intelligence Relevant in Afghanistan, a paper that described shortcomings in serving forces in the war zone. Mike decried the fact that the U.S. forces in Afghanistan lacked fluency with the micro-details of the political and sociological dynamics in each Afghan village, something under his control as the guy on the ground, not something the national intelligence enterprise could influence. It reminded me of the quote from the Pogo comic strip, "We have met the enemy, and he is us." Nonetheless, in 2011, I brought Mike to the ODNI specifically to work on how the bigger intelligence community engages our partners. That September, I helped pin a third star on his uniform, promoting him from Major General to Lieutenant General. He served in ODNI for less than a year before USDI Mike Vickers and I agreed to recommend that Leon Panetta appoint him as DIA director. Mike had spent his career, particularly the decade since 9/11, on the tactical edge of battle. He had never directed a large organization before, and he made some of the same mistakes I'd made as a new DIA director in 1991, including not properly engaging the workforce before undertaking a major reorganization. He could have rectified the situation, but he didn't address the civilian workforce's concerns when they were brought to him, and he made matters worse by increasingly demanding that civilians behave like uniformed service members. Stories started leaking out of DIA that he was using analysts to chase down crazy conspiracy theories, which the workforce had dubbed Flynn Facts. He also clashed with his boss in the Pentagon, Mike Vickers, and publicly criticized the president's policy decisions, asserting that the president should refer to terrorists as Islamic extremists. That made sense from a war-fighting perspective, but the president was also concerned with maintaining relationships with Islamic governments around the world that had repudiated the terrorists. For Mike Vickers, Flynn's insubordination became too much to bear. For me, It was his impact on the workforce at DIA that led to our mutual decision to make a change. In late 2013, we met with Flynn in Vickers' office in the Pentagon to let him know we were ending his tour a year early. He could remain until August 2014, which would allow him to retire with the grade and pay of a lieutenant general. He seemed to take it well and retired the following summer. I had a lot of respect for what Mike had done during his years of service, and I didn't hold it against him that things hadn't worked out at DIA. So I was taken aback in December 2015 when pictures of Mike sitting at dinner with Vladimir Putin surfaced in the media. From his public statements that followed, I gathered that he felt an affinity with the Russians when it came to dealing with terrorists in a tough way. He even talked about meeting privately with Russian intelligence to discuss fighting the Islamic State, another decision I was uneasy with. When he'd been DIA director, I'd cautioned Mike to be wary of the Russians attempting to woo him, as they had attempted with me when I'd been DIA director. Looking at pictures of Mike sitting with Putin at dinner, I wondered if the Russian courtship had been more appealing to Mike in his retirement. Regardless, he knew that taking Russian government money compromised him personally, particularly since he was consulting with several Republican presidential campaigns at the time. In February, he officially joined Mr. Trump's campaign, bringing his connection to RT and an angry, fiery edge that he'd acquired sometime after retiring in 2014. Meanwhile, Mr. Trump's campaign interests continued to align more with Russia's, and specifically with Putin's. In the first year of his campaign, Trump boasted many times that Putin was someone he could make deals with, and pointed out that Putin had prior positive experiences working with businessmen turned national leaders, particularly Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi and German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder. The two began a public courtship in the media, and in July 2015, Trump announced that if he was elected president, Putin would extradite Snowden to the United States because Putin respected him but not Obama. In September, on Fox News, he said of Putin, "I will tell you that I think in terms of leadership, he is getting an A, and our president is not doing so well." In October, he supported Putin's aggression in Syria, telling The Guardian, "He's going to want to bomb ISIS because he doesn't want ISIS going into Russia, and so he's going to want to bomb ISIS. Vladimir Putin is going to want to really go after ISIS, and if he doesn't, it'll be a big shock to everybody." In December, as the Russian social media trolls began to focus on helping candidate Trump's cause, Putin seemed to endorse Trump, calling him a colorful and talented man, and indicating that he would welcome the closer relations with the United States that might come with Trump's election. Shortly after, Trump had an on-air conversation with Joe Scarborough of MSNBC, during which Scarborough reminded him that Putin was someone who kills journalists, political opponents, and invades countries. "He's running his country, and at least he's a leader, unlike what we have in this country," Trump responded. Scarborough reiterated, "He kills journalists who don't agree with him." Trump said, "Well, I think our country does plenty of killing also, Joe." Then, in January, when a British inquiry found that the FSB operation to kill former KGB agent Alexander Litvinenko was probably approved by Mr. Patrushev and also by President Putin, Trump stated publicly, "He says he didn't do it. Many people say it wasn't him. So who knows who did it?" Getting its target audience to conclude that facts and truth are unknowable is the true objective of any disinformation campaign. Climate change deniers aren't trying to convince people that surveys they commissioned are better than those agreed upon by the vast majority of scientists. Anti-government conspiracy theorists aren't really trying to convince people that some towns in the Midwest are governed under Sharia law, or that Jade Helm was an attempt by Obama to come for their guns. If someone actually believes the falsehood, that's a bonus. But the primary objective is to get readers or viewers to throw their hands up and give up on facts. Do vaccines cause autism? Maybe. Was Senator Ted Cruz's father involved with President Kennedy's assassination? Anything's possible. Is Hillary Clinton running a child sex ring out of the basement of a D.C. pizza parlor? Who knows? In February, Flynn joined the Trump campaign, and on March 1st, voters in 11 states went to the primary polls. Mr. Trump won 7 states outright and finished a close enough second in Senator Ted Cruz's home state of Texas. He took a considerable lead in committed Republican delegates, just as Secretary Clinton extended her lead over Senator Bernie Sanders in committed Democratic delegates, and the Kremlin decided to fully support Mr. Trump's election bid. Putin didn't formally endorse Trump, which the Russians believed would hurt his chances at election, but RT anchors began full-throated praise, particularly targeting the base of voters most incensed at politicians in Washington. They pushed the message that while Mr. Trump would be the nominee of the Republican Party, he was nonetheless a complete and welcome outsider. That was music to the ears of Trump's campaign, and he quickly returned the favor, repeating at public events and in press interviews that the United States was paying too much into NATO, the alliance specifically established to counter the Soviets, and that it should reconsider its obligations to defend NATO nations who weren't paying their fair share. RT jumped on the story, reporting, "Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump slammed NATO on the campaign trail this week, saying he can live with breaking up the military alliance, which he calls obsolete." In April, Mr. Trump first used the phrase "lying crooked Hillary" to refer to his likely opponent in the primary election. RT, Fox News, and paid and unpaid trolls across social media latched on to the moniker. Russia and the Trump campaign seemed to be quite in sync, but that didn't necessarily mean they were colluding, coordinating their efforts behind closed doors. They may simply have had a lot in common, a strong dislike for both the Washington political establishment and Hillary Clinton personally, a proclivity for social media, particularly Twitter, which meant they'd end up sharing each other's ideas on the Internet, and a genuine delight in wallowing in conspiracy theories. As spring turned into summer in 2016, and as Mr. Trump promoted pro-Russian lobbyist Paul Manafort to campaign chairman, the USIC was well aware that Russia was trolling social media networks, and we knew that RT and Sputnik were spouting propaganda to large American audiences, but none of these efforts seemed radically different from what they'd done before. The social media trolling was a new phenomenon, but also a tactic that had backfired on Russian interests during the 2014 Ukraine elections, largely because it incited threats of violence that had closed polls in Russian-controlled areas. RT had grown its audience considerably since 2012, but was pushing the same sort of messages and was once again targeting the right as much as the left, hosting a Green Party debate on May 9th and a Libertarian Party debate on May 12th, and pushing the agendas of both. That effort served both to undermine the two-party system and to take votes away from Secretary Clinton. So while it looked as if the Trump campaign and Russian propaganda were working in tandem, I didn't see any evidence at the time that there was a direct coordination between them. I was, however, convinced that the Russians needed to be confronted about their cyber intrusions into American parties, campaigns, and state electoral databases. On May 18th, I announced during a cybersecurity event at the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington that the IC had indications of Russian hackers targeting presidential campaigns, our first public warning shot at Russia 6 months before Election Day. Beyond being the first to call out Russian interference publicly, I continued to stay away from any involvement in the ongoing election shenanigans. I figured at the time that the last thing our country needed was any appearance that the intelligence community was involved in partisan politics. As someone who'd served as a political appointee in both Republican and Democrat administrations, I didn't have a personal dog in the fight. At the same time, I was deeply and personally bothered by the divisive rhetoric that continued to be a hallmark of the campaigning. My biggest concern with the political rhetoric from the Republican campaigns and Russian propaganda was that the demonizing of minority groups in the United States was having a tangible impact on how we treated one another as Americans. In May, Georgetown University published a study on escalating violence against Muslim Americans. They reported that anti-Muslim political rhetoric first escalated in August 2015, and then September saw a surge in violence against Muslims, which kept rising. As the study noted, anti-Muslim attacks surged once more in December 2015. There were 53 total attacks that month, 17 of which targeted mosques and Islamic schools, and 5 of which targeted Muslim homes. By comparison, when the presidential election season began just 9 months earlier, there were only 2 anti-Muslim attacks. Attacks on Muslims during this month constitute approximately 1/3 of all attacks last year. In fact, in December 2015, anti-Muslim attacks occurred almost daily and often multiple times a day. That troubled me professionally as well as personally, and the rhetoric was only becoming more inflammatory as candidate Trump again called for a ban on refugees from Islamic countries entering the United States, and pondered aloud banning all travel to this country from Muslim nations. He and several GOP congressional members castigated President Obama for not referring to terrorist groups as radical Islamists, as though uttering that phrase would change anything on the battlefield. At the time, I was primarily focused on leaving the IC positioned for the next generation to take the reins and excel, particularly when it came to technology and the exceptional people of the IC. I was challenging attendees at the Geospatial Intelligence Forum to not be afraid to fail in the pursuit of technological breakthroughs. I asked the IC Women's Summit in March and the African American and Hispanic Hiring Summit in May to find ways to encourage diversity. On Wednesday, June 8th, I met with the IC Pride Group and was again taken with their joy at finding a community within the IC. They were so happy that after years of living under draconian rules, they could finally live openly, honest about who they were, without fear of losing their clearances, jobs, or social standing. That feeling came crashing down 4 days later, on Sunday morning, June 12th, when the LGBT community was targeted with violence yet again, when a man opened fire inside Pulse, a gay nightclub in Orlando, killing 49 people and wounding 53. No event since 9/11 had affected me as deeply as Orlando did. It was just so unfair for a community that had lived under oppression and fear for so long to be targeted by someone with such hate, and the anguish of the moment was even more intense since I'd just celebrated service with a segment of that community, one I thought of as family, because they were also intelligence officers. On Tuesday, June 14th, I met with the National Security Team and President Obama in Treasury Department headquarters for an update on the progress we'd made to counter the Islamic State in the ungoverned spaces in Iraq and Syria. After it ended, we walked out to a press conference for the president to talk about the parts of our meeting he could discuss publicly. As is typical, two other leaders, this time Secretary of Treasury Jack Lew, our host for the meeting, and chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joe Dunford, and I, stood behind him. In these situations, I always try to do my best potted plant impression, standing motionless and expressionless, becoming part of the scenery. Just before we stepped out, the president pulled Joe and me aside and told us he wanted to apologize ahead of time because he tried never to put us on display for a political statement. As I stood listening while he began speaking to the press, channeling my inner bonsai, I wondered what he had meant. Halfway through the conference, the president's tone changed as he addressed the criticism that he refused to use the phrase radical Islam to label terrorists. We're starting to see where this kind of rhetoric and loose talk and sloppiness about who exactly we're fighting, where this can lead us, he said. We now have proposals from the presumptive Republican nominee for President of the United States to bar all Muslims from immigrating to America. He asked, "Where does this stop?" The Orlando killer, one of the San Bernardino killers, the Fort Hood killer, they were all U.S. citizens. Are we going to start treating all Muslim Americans differently? Are we going to start subjecting them to special surveillance? As he continued to speak, I felt my thoughts carried away from that auditorium. I thought of the Muslim American leaders I'd met with, of their patriotism, and their fear of how the country they loved had treated the communities they represent. In the press conference, the president was saying that if we implied we were at war with an entire religion, we'd be doing the Islamic State's work for them. And if we demonized Muslims and other groups in the United States, we'd lose sight of what this nation stood for. We'd regretted the times in our past when we'd given in to fear and lashed out at minority groups of American citizens. If we abandoned our values, the terrorists will have won. He talked about diversity as a great strength of this country, about the outpouring of support in Orlando from all corners and all walks of life. I thought about our IC Pride group. My colleagues had for years hidden their true selves, not for personal gain, but to serve, a sacrifice I couldn't imagine making. America's intelligence force worked, fought, and sacrificed in the shadows, without expecting praise, and these exceptional people had finally gained the ability to live openly as who they really were, and that freedom and joy had reverted to fear again so quickly and so savagely. The president finished with a message about how our military members supported each other regardless of what they looked like or whom they loved. "Those are the values that ISIL is trying to destroy," he said, "and we shouldn't help them do it." Our military had come a long way to arrive at a place where that statement was true and could be acknowledged publicly. I'd been there on that journey. When the president finished, we retired to an anteroom, and he bid quick farewells to Joe and Jack. When he turned to me, I started to lose it. Tears welling, I managed to babble something about how proud I was of him. He pulled me into a hug for just a moment, and we then went our separate ways back to work. In the car, I couldn't help but think about how far the president and I had come since our first meeting in the Oval Office, when we chatted about lifting weights and doing cardio on alternating days, which is when I guess he decided I would be okay to hire as his DNI. I went back to Liberty Crossing, satisfied that I could focus on the community for my final 7 months instead of being caught up in the election. On May 26th, Donald Trump clinched the Republican nomination, and on June 6th, Hillary Clinton clinched the Democratic nomination. I was thinking about how I would dance quietly off the stage on January 20th, hoping that no one really noticed I was leaving. Events of the next 2 months would prove both of those to be extremely naive wishes. On July 5th, Jim Comey held a press conference to read a statement about the results of the FBI investigation into Secretary Clinton's emails. I didn't know anything about this beforehand, and I consider it a good thing that I wasn't told, as it demonstrates the independence the FBI has with its investigations, particularly when U.S. persons are involved. Calling a press conference was an unusual step, but former President Bill Clinton had complicated the situation on June 27th, when he was seen boarding Attorney General Loretta Lynch's plane in Phoenix. When news of the meeting, which both said was unrelated to the investigation, leaked out, Attorney General Lynch appeared to be compromised and therefore unable to make an unbiased decision about prosecuting Secretary Clinton. So rather than quietly passing FBI findings and recommendations to the Justice Department behind closed doors, as would typically be done, Jim Comey opted for a press conference. By that point, I had read the emails in question and come to my own conclusions. None of them was sent to or from anyone outside of government, and none was marked in a way that would indicate it was classified. But several did discuss sensitive intelligence sourcing that shouldn't have been transmitted across open internet connections, where they could be intercepted by an adversary. Secretary Clinton hadn't intentionally disclosed secrets, as CIA Director Petraeus had done. But I was surprised that she'd participated in email conversations about such sensitive information. If a line IC employee had done the same, I expect we would have held proceedings to decide if that person should keep his or her security clearance and continue employment. So I didn't know how Jim was going to handle this, and I watched live with as much interest as anyone. The next 15 minutes were riveting, starting with Jim's opening assertion that he hadn't coordinated or shared his remarks with the Department of Justice or any other government organization, and affirmed, "They do not know what I'm about to say." My entire front office stopped work to watch as Jim laid out the process the FBI had used to investigate the matter. They had come to the conclusion that 110 of the 30,000 emails given by the State Department to the Justice Department contained classified material when they were sent, including 8 email chains that had top-secret information. There were another 2,000 emails that had information that was unclassified when they were sent, but was later classified. In investigating the servers Secretary Clinton had used, the FBI had also found several thousand work-related emails that were not in the collection of 30,000 that she had given to the State Department. The Bureau didn't assess that she'd hidden those, merely that her personal server had no archiving capability, and they'd not turned up in normal recovery procedures. After 9 minutes of discussing the investigative process, Jim changed tone. "That's what we have done. Now let me tell you what we have found. Although we did not find clear evidence that Secretary Clinton or her colleagues intended to violate laws governing the handling of classified information, there is evidence that they were extremely careless in their handling of very sensitive, highly classified information." He noted that that included 7 email chains with information from special access programs, protected even more carefully than other top-secret intelligence. The FBI had also determined that it was possible that hostile actors had gained access to Secretary Clinton's account, but that the FBI didn't have the capability to know if they actually had. Finally, he said he was opting for unusual transparency in discussing his recommendations to the Justice Department. Although there is evidence of potential violations of the statutes regarding the handling of classified information, he noted, our judgment is that no reasonable prosecutor would bring such a case, further stating that previous such cases brought for prosecution involved some combination of clearly intentional and willful mishandling of classified information, or vast quantities of materials exposed in such a way as to support an inference of intentional misconduct, or indications of disloyalty to the United States, or efforts to obstruct justice. We do not see those things here. He continued, to be clear, this is not to suggest that in similar circumstances, a person who engaged in this activity would face no consequences. To the contrary, those individuals are often subject to security or administrative sanctions. But that is not what we are deciding now. As a result, although the Department of Justice makes final decisions on matters like this, we are expressing to Justice our view that no charges are appropriate in this case. He thanked the FBI for its apolitical professionalism, adding, I couldn't be prouder to be part of this organization. And then left the stage. To me, it was a stunning rebuke of a presidential candidate by the director of the FBI, and what could only have been a difficult decision for my friend and colleague who'd spent his career in service to the nation and to speaking truth to power. In this case, the power was the American people. Whatever the consequences would be, he did what he considered to be the right thing and in the best interests of the nation. The Russians, to be fair, along with everyone else, immediately jumped on Jim's announcement. RT led with video of Clinton saying, "Nothing I sent or received was marked classified at the time," followed by Comey's acknowledgment that 110 emails in 52 email chains have been determined by the owning agency to contain classified information at the time they were sent or received. A viewer would have had to pay close attention to appreciate the significance of the word marked. RT, Sputnik, and the online trolls played off one another to portray Clinton as corrupt and the FBI as complicit. Any number of conspiracy theories took root. Some alleged that she deleted the emails to cover up crimes. On July 10th, Seth Rich, a young Democratic National Committee staff member, was killed in Washington in a botched robbery. Within hours, internet conspiracy theorists, including the Russians, suggested that Rich had been murdered at Clinton's behest to cover up the email leaks. They dragged out the Clinton body count rumors, dating back to the 1980s, which claimed that Bill and Hillary had been assassinating political rivals. Leading into the party conventions that summer, the Russians had laid sufficient groundwork to get a subset of American voters to believe nearly anything about Hillary Clinton. Still, if things appeared bad for Clinton and the Democrats, they were worse for her opponent and his party. Even before it officially kicked off on July 18th, the Republican National Convention seemed headed for chaos and animosity between Mr. Trump's team and the old guard GOP. In particular, Trump campaign staff worked behind the scenes to rewrite the party platform, which, when it was released, noticeably dropped calling for maintaining or increasing sanctions on Russia and of promising lethal defensive weapons to Ukraine in support of their resistance to Russian aggression. Reflecting deep divisions in the Republican Party, the governor of Ohio, John Kasich, who had run against Mr. Trump for the nomination, refused to come to Cleveland to introduce him as nominee. With the Trump team setting the agenda, the convention seemed to revel in pessimism about the state of the nation and the direction it was heading. On Monday, Mike Flynn led the crowd in chanting, "Lock her up," in reference to the Clinton email scandal. He seemed so consumed by partisan anger that I barely recognized the man I'd traveled the world with when he'd still been in uniform. On Wednesday, Senator Cruz, who finished second in primary voting, declined to endorse Trump and, to raucous boos and jeers, told Republicans to vote your conscience. On the final night, Mr. Trump delivered a dark speech about how far the nation had fallen, declaring that he was the only person who could make America great again. Accepting the nomination, he said, "The crime and violence that today afflicts our nation will soon come to an end. Beginning on January 20th, 2017, safety will be restored." While RT focused their coverage on Black Lives Matter protesters who had clashed with police in the streets of Cleveland, most media coverage of the Republican National Convention portrayed a broken Republican Party in crisis. Before most of the media had landed in Philadelphia for the Democratic Convention 4 days later, Russia launched its big surprise. Russian intelligence, specifically their military intelligence agency, GRU, the agency with which Mike Flynn had met, had quietly gained access to the Democratic National Committee networks in July 2015. Sometime in March 2016, Putin and the Russian leadership decided that it was worth the risk of diplomatic blowback if they were caught, and the GRU went on offense, exfiltrating emails and large volumes of data. In April, Russia used a third-party cutout to send more than 19,000 DNC emails and more than 8,000 documents to WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, attempting to cover its tracks and to give WikiLeaks some degree of deniability in knowing the source of the leaks. It took WikiLeaks 3 months to verify the emails were authentic before it released them, and I find it implausible that Assange, as he claims, didn't figure out during that period that Russian intelligence was his source. The DNC had actually realized they had a problem in April and hired the cybersecurity firm CrowdStrike to assess the situation and try to save their systems. CrowdStrike detected the Russian activity and did what it could to quietly remediate the damage. On June 14th, the DNC went public, acknowledging they'd been hacked by Russian intelligence. The next day, a hacker self-styled as Guccifer 2.0 claimed to have been the perpetrator. The name was clearly a reference to the Guccifer who had first revealed Secretary Clinton's email address and domain information in March 2013. Guccifer 2.0 claimed to be Romanian, just as the original had, although he communicated very well in Russian and not well at all